This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're doing something different with our theme. As you know, we usually go with a specific mental illness or a general factor in mental health that can affect us all. However, we have never before done an episode on a specific day or incident. Today, we are talking about the September 11 attacks, also known as 9/11, when a series of four coordinated terror attacks were carried out against the United States of America. Those of us who were alive at the time will know firsthand the global shock and how people all over the world had their idea of safety changed. Now, 20 years later, the filmmakers David Belton and Bjorn Johnson expanded on the incredible work of Ruth Segal, who archived the experiences of survivors. They did this in the form of a documentary film called Memory Box, Echoes of 9/11. To give you some background on Ruth's work, in the months following the attacks, nearly 600 people entered a simple plywood video booth. Inside this safe space, they were able to use a self-operated camera to record their deepest feelings of their first-hand experiences. Now, as the witnesses return to the box 20 years later, with new families, new hobbies, new connections, even amongst the COVID pandemic, it became clear that there are countless ways to move forward, even whilst acknowledging the past. Today I'm interviewing the co-director of this film, David Belton, who is an award-winning writer and filmmaker with nearly 30 years' experience making documentaries and dramas, including for BBC News and BBC Documentaries. For example, he created the BAFTA award-winning documentary on Vincent van Gogh that I've also watched. I am also speaking to Don Marshall. His wife Shelley was working at the Pentagon when Flight 77 crashed into the building at 9:37 a.m. In the episode, you will hear an incredibly moving conversation revisiting these experiences and what our guests learned through recording them for this film. And before I wrap up my intro, I want to pause on a note that Don found written by his wife years later. "We only have a finite number of days on this earth. Make them extraordinary and fill them with passion." With that in mind, I hope you appreciate today's conversation. I already know it's one I'll always remember, just as we remember the lives that were lost that day.
Hi there, I'm Don Marshall, and I'm very happy to be with you today. I'm here to talk about 9/11, and I guess the best place to start is that morning. It was an unusual day for us. Shelley's portion of the Pentagon was actually being remodeled, or it was scheduled to be remodeled. And so she was going to have to stay late that night because she was in charge of the move. So we ended up taking two different cars. I got the kids, and that was a lot of fun because Drake was 3 years old and Chandler was almost 2 years old. So they were old enough to be very active in the back seat and require a lot of attention while I was driving. So got them to the daycare at the Pentagon. They were actually in the Pentagon daycare, which was just outside the building. And I remember pretty much my last image of Shelley is the kids. I was carrying them into the daycare. They saw her down the hall. They squirmed out of my arms and ran down the hall to her yelling, "Mommy, Mommy, Mommy." And she just reached down and scooped them up and gave them hugs and kisses. And so that's, you know, a great way to remember her. We went out to the parking lot after that, after we dropped the kids off. And I remember she had just put on lipstick, so she gave me an air kiss. And that was the last time I saw her. I went to my office, which was about 2 miles away, and got to work. And then had a phone call from her at about 9 o'clock. And she wanted to compare notes on the World Trade Center, because the plane had hit the World Trade Center at that point. And we were all trying to find information. At the time, we both worked for the Defense Intelligence Agency. She was in the budget office, and I was doing counter-drug work for them. But I was an intelligence analyst. I wanted to figure out what was going on, so I kind of rushed her off the phone. And I'll always regret that. About, I don't know, about 20, 25 minutes later is when the plane hit the building. A friend of mine, a coworker who was homesick and lived near the Pentagon, called the office and told me that somebody had bombed the Pentagon. And that was the first I knew of it. And at that point, I just said, I have to go. And he said, oh, that's right. I jumped in the car. I drove through. It was a place called Crystal City, just south of the Pentagon. Tall office buildings and hotels. So I think the building muffled the sound. And people didn't know why I was speeding, doing 55 or 60 in a 25-mile-an-hour zone. But I was driving as quickly as I could to the daycare. I got there, and the kids weren't there. They'd been evacuated. So I went to go look for them, and I remember finding them was just probably the happiest moment of my life, just picking them up and holding them. And then I realized that Shelley wasn't there, and it became the worst moment of my life because I knew that if there was any way for her to be to those kids, she would be. So I borrowed a cell phone. We didn't all have cell phones or smartphones at the time. I borrowed a cell phone and called her parents who lived nearby. And I said, I'm bringing the kids to you. I need to go look for Shelley in the Pentagon. And I remember her father said, you can't do that, Don. We're going on vacation. He had no idea that the Pentagon had been hit. So I had to tell him, it's been hit. I need to bring the kids to you. So we met at a gas station about halfway in between. And I remember telling him, this doesn't look good because the smoke is coming from where the helipad is. And that's very close to Shelley's office. So I went back and began an odyssey around the Pentagon. There was a big wall between the daycare and the Pentagon, so I couldn't just go directly to the site. I actually had to walk all the way around the Pentagon. And along the way, I remember seeing a triage center where they had brought people out, and they were all wrapped up in blankets and things like that. And I remember thinking, I'd know if she was there, I would feel it. And I didn't feel it, so I kept on walking. And then I remember there was another image that actually, the only time I've had a flashback was of this image of, there were about, I don't know, 20 airmen in camouflage, and they were all standing in a row. Two, and there were four of them across and about five deep, and each one had his hand on the fella in front of him's shoulder and then on the shoulder of the man next to him. And they ducked their heads, and they jogged slowly into the building to go look for people. And, you know, that one of the things that was comforting to me was seeing that and seeing the firefighters later in the day. Nobody could have done more to help those people who were in there. You know, I can't sit there and say I could have done it better. I don't think I could have. I mean, like I said, and that did bring a degree of comfort. At any rate, I made it all the way around the building, couldn't get inside the security perimeter that had grown up around the crash site. So I bided my time and eventually was at a convenience store nearby where all the media had set up. And I was trying to sort of probe the media to find out what they knew about where the rescuers were and things like that. When a fellow pulled up in a pickup truck and said he needed to get supplies for the rescue workers. And he went into the convenience store, and the convenience store owner said, take whatever you need. And we just took it and we dumped it in the truck. There was no money. Nothing changed hands. It was just, you need it, take it. We dumped it in the truck, drove over there. I thought this was my chance to get inside the perimeter. I probably could have then, but there was a fellow who was coming out who was wounded. I don't know if he just turned his ankle, broke his ankle or what, but he needed help walking. So I helped him into the truck and got him out of the area there, thinking, you know, I need some good karma. So maybe if I help this guy, that'll help me down the road. We made a second run of supplies to the security perimeter. And that was at that point, somebody yelled that they needed stretcher bearers. And I was able to jump over the barrier and grab a stretcher and just mingle with the stretcher bearers. And then I had to wait. I sat outside the building looking at the gash in the building, looking at the door to the corridor that led to Shelley's office, and waited. And I remember they taught us how to pick up burn victims. You know, but I also remember thinking how many husbands stand outside a burning building with their wife maybe inside you know. And at the time, I had no idea whether she was in there or not, because as I said, we had one cell phone, she had it. Her father had given me his cell phone, but by then all the cell phones were down. You couldn't, you know, I didn't know if she got evacuated out of another end of the building, if she had been taken to a hospital. I had no idea. So I waited for my opportunity to go into the building, and it just, it never happened. And at 6 o'clock, they brought in soldiers from Fort Myer to take over as stretcher bearers. And that's when I had to make a decision. And that was one of the hardest decisions of my life, is if she's in there, she expects me to come get her. But, you know, on the other hand, we have kids and they're wondering where their parents are. And if I go in there, there's a good chance with all the smoke that's pouring out of there that I'm not coming back out. So, you know, as a husband, you have this duty to your wife. But as a parent, you have a duty to your kids. And I knew that as a parent, Shelley would want me to be with the kids. It still doesn't make this, I don't know. I don't know about the decision to this day. But I left and went back to the kids. And we tried to organize, you know, reach out to fire departments, whoever would listen, and tell them, go to this part of the building. And we didn't find out that she was gone until the 14th. It took that long. So, and that's how it ended for us, with a phone call on the 14th. And then I had to start thinking about how I was going to be a single dad and how I was going to take care of our kids and keep them safe and make Shelley proud.
Of course. And thank you so much for sharing that. It's striking to me, having watched the film and seen so many people share their testimonies, how so often there is this kind of clarity that can happen in extreme situations, that can kind of wash over people, even if you're in shock, even if you feel you have no idea what to do. I can see how, of course, you did go through the thought process of, okay, who do I need to protect? Who are my people in this situation? And what would Shelley want?
Yeah. So there was what I wanted, and there was what Shelley wanted, and what the kids needed.
Yeah.
So there was an equation there, I guess, that I didn't realize I was working through.
Yeah, of course. And, you know, how do any of us wrap our head around an event like that, even all these years later? And at this point, I want to bring in David Belton, the co-director, and ask you about, in looking to document stories like Don's and so many others, where did you begin in this filmmaking process?
Thanks, Bobby. And yes, so just to introduce myself, I'm David Belton. I'm one of the two directors that made Memory Box Echoes of 9/11. And I mean, in answer to your question, I mean, just sitting here and listening to Don telling his story, which I've been privileged enough to hear a few times, both from listening on his testimony that he gave back in 2002, but also just in the conversations that we've had. And I'm fortunate enough to say in person as well, when he came over to England. It never stops being the most extraordinary and vivid and sort of raw experience listening to Don. And I think, in a sense, you know, the bravery of just still fronting up to that question about what to do, where to be a father or to be a husband. I'm just in awe, really, of you, Don, in the way you've never let that question slide. And I think it's a testament to you, really. But I think that, in a sense, Don's testimony was almost one of the first that I heard when my fellow director, Bjorn Johnson, first introduced me to the testimonies that had been recorded by Ruth Sergel, who was the artist who had started the project back in 2002. And once you listened to people like Don, and there were many, many others, talking about their experience as a filmmaker, I kind of realized that we were in very privileged territory, because it was such an unusual thing to watch. Here were people that had voluntarily walked into a wooden video booth. I mean, it couldn't have been more kind of Heath Robinson if you tried, really. There was just a little camera and a little on and off button, and people could sit down, close the door and speak. And they would turn the camera on and switch it off as and when they wanted to. So they were totally in control of their own story. And as a filmmaker, that's just not the way it's supposed to be. You know, I ask the questions and we go into a story with a very clear idea about what we think the story is. And here were 575 people that had walked into the booth in New York, the Pentagon, and also down in Shanksville, where the fourth plane crashed. And they were all taking control of their own story. And so it was a very unique experience to watch this material. And I remember turning to Bjorn and saying, we have to make this. We have to make this film, but it's not going to be like a normal film. We're going to direct this and we are going to shape it as we do with every film, but we're going to be curators as well. There's a sort of responsibility that lies with us to somehow find a truth to what people were doing in going into the box, which was more than just simply trying to retell the events of the day. That there were four planes, three buildings, and a terrible, terrible tragedy and a terrible crime. People did go in to tell that story. They did go in to tell what happened to them, but they also seemed to be going in to do something else. And that's what, in a sense, this safe space that the box was provided people. Sometimes they didn't even know they were going in to question something deeper than the events of the day, that there was a psychological need. Sometimes they absolutely knew that they were going in there to address that. And so our job was to try and curate and find a truth in all those testimonies that would, in a sense, give people a better understanding of what do you do when you're confronted with something as traumatic, something where you have no control and as horrific as that, and how do you get past it? So that became the intention, at least, of what we were trying to do with our film. Mm-hmm.
And I think there's something about that freedom of the process of going into the box and choosing your time to start and stop, your own perspective on this, that I think seemed to really bring out such insights that would even surprise the participants themselves. Because, you know, how do you grapple with something as horrific as this? How do you know how to tell your story? And perhaps to an extent, in being given that freedom to tell it in your own words at your own pace, you may hear yourself say things and have insights that you just didn't even realize. Don, would you mind sharing a bit about what that experience was like?
You're exactly right. I went into that box. I had a master's degree in history, so I was a historian who was stepping into the box to give an oral history of the events of the day so that they would be recorded for posterity. And somewhere along the way, in the dark of the box, I talked about decisions I had to make. You know, at that time, it was a couple of years later that still stuck with me. And the first time around, it was surprising. It was almost like stepping into a space capsule or a confessional. You were in this, like I said, in this darkness, and you were going to go in and tell a story. The second time around was also pretty fascinating, because it forced you to look back on the 20 years in a way. I mean, I knew the 20-year anniversary was coming up, and I was going to look back and say, wow, changed. What's different, and what's the same? And this forced me to think about it and to make some assessments about what I got right, what I got wrong, what I still struggle with. And I guess it was going back to a comfortable place, right? I mean, it was a little, I got to be honest, David, it was a little more lush than the first box.
We just wanted to look after you, Don.
Yeah. But it was, I guess I kind of knew what I was getting into in terms of I'm going to go back into the box and I'm going to have this opportunity to just speak. And this time it's not an oral history. This time it's taking things into account and coming up with a balance sheet, if you will, and just trying to figure out where you were 20 years later. I don't know. I'm just, if I can ask a question, I mean, I'm just curious if David, if you and Bjorn realized the impact you were going to have on people when they got into that box and when they came out. I mean, for me, it was a very therapeutic experience, not just being in the box, but actually seeing the documentary and seeing these other people who had gone through a similar experience or gone through 9/11 and came out the other side resilient. I mean, for me, it kind of gave me permission to acknowledge my resilience. So, I mean, I don't know if this is any of this is what you and Bjorn anticipated, David, but it was an incredible experience.
We realized we needed to get in touch with each of these people to get permission for us to use the testimony. So luckily, Ruth Sergel, the artist, had very sensibly kept numbers and emails. Isn't it amazing how many numbers and emails are still the same? And we were able quite quickly to track down everybody. I mean, even when they didn't have the same email or didn't have the same number, because we have very, very brilliant researcher, Helen, who's half my age and therefore is very connected to social media. She was able to just find everybody, and she was wonderful and brilliant, and then began to reach out to each of the people that we wanted to talk to. And very quickly, the first thing was a hello. We were making this film. Would you be interested in letting us use your testimony? And then the conversation opened out. How are you? What's going on in your life? What's happened since? Where are the ups and where are the downs been? And of course, this is all done in Zoom during the pandemic. And Helen and myself and Bjorn spent a lot, and Hugo, the producer, spent a lot of time talking to people and getting very close connections with them. And so from that, we suddenly realized that people had remarkable experiences after, and were also in a really interesting space where they were reflecting, just as Don was saying, they were able to reflect on what the last 20 years was like, what had they found out about themselves, what had they learned about how to recover, how to get past these events, but also how to hold on to things. Mm-hmm. All this stuff was just, it was just rich. So we thought, let's build another box. So we built another box, and we invited a sort of a group in the end of about 30, which were of people that we talked to that we felt would have a very interesting array of different experiences that we could channel into perhaps the last half of the film. So that's the background to Don's question, but I just thought it would be useful. And in answer to your question, Don, I mean, we didn't know. I mean, I sat there and chatted to you, and I knew you were a highly intelligent, deep emotional intelligence and thoughtfulness and reflection. But getting you into a box, seeing what was going to happen, I had no idea. And we didn't know. So that when people did sit down, they sat down in the box in New York or Washington, and it was connected by the internet to the camera to where we were in London. So we were sitting in our edit suite in London, looking at the screen and looking at the inside of the box as each person came and sat down. And I mean, I can honestly say there were at least two dozen times when one or other of us that were sitting there, we usually two of us or three of us in the room listening, had to leave the room because they were feeling so overwrought by what they were listening to. I mean, that's partly because Americans are just really good at telling their stories, okay? They're natural storytellers, and they're very good at explaining and being open. And there was that amazing sort of refreshing sense of what we were listening to. But also they were just incredibly moving and very honest. And I think, as you say, Don, that safe space, that dark, cavernous, a little bit more luxurious, but not much, but a little bit more, just gave people permission to just say, oh, I've been here before, and last time it was good. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm going to do that again.
Thank you so much for sharing that and for, you know, adding that to the conversation, because I think that's something that I was going to come on to is how much this must have impacted you, you know, not only revisiting the box, but also you, David, watching these testimonies, and how do you process it, even secondhand, hearing how raw and unfiltered these conversations are. And I want to pick up on something you mentioned, Don, about the permission you felt by watching other people's experiences and seeing it edited into a film in this way. You mentioned about a permission to feel certain things like your resilience. And I wonder if, because of what happened on that day, it felt to you that you couldn't find anything from it positive, that any learning about yourself or the world or what everything means.
It was just that until I saw other people who had, as David said, were able to take what happened and move past it, but keep 9/11 as part of their life in a constructive way, I felt like I was now I was part of a club, right? Part of my journey was made easier by Shelley, because I talk in the box about finding the words that she left behind. You know, you have only a finite number of days on this earth. Make them extraordinary and fill them with passion. You know, that was sort of my guidance, and I've tried to live by that. And that gave me a better life after 9/11. The kids, being able to raise and be with those kids, just, it was such a gift. And they've turned out so well. And I'll give most of the credit to them and Shelley. But, you know, things worked out. I remarried. I found I fell in love again. And, you know, I've had people ask me, how can you do that to Shelley? But the thing is, I learned that the heart can expand, and things have gone well in the past 20 years. And I think, you know, that would make Shelley happy. So that I think that was with me all along, but just I was kind of closeted about it. And then this, seeing other people like this, it allowed me to open the door.
Yeah. No, that's exactly what I was getting at, that idea of feeling closeted about it. And then you go into a closet and you release it.
Go ahead, Don. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
I was just going to say that one of the most important things that I did, and I mean, this is a mental health podcast, I just wanted to put in a plug for counselors. I mean, at the time, DIA provided me with a grief counselor, and I realized that I can't afford to screw this up. I've got these kids now. They're my responsibility. And I spent 6 months with that grief counselor, and that was probably one of the best decisions I ever made. So, you know, for your listeners and anybody on the fence about this, it's just a smart thing to do. So.
That's so brilliant to hear. And it's absolutely one of the things I was going to ask you about, was what things you were able to do in that 20-year space. And David, if I may come back to you, in going through the footage yourself and watching every testimony and watching, I wasn't even aware that you watched the newer testimonies as they were recorded live. Could you share a bit about what the impact was like on you and your team personally, and what you were able to put in place for yourselves to cope, but also the kind of supports for the participants?
It's such an interesting question, because, of course, we're on the other side of the Atlantic. We're in an edit suite just looking at the screens. And, you know, we're rough and tough TV people, except we're bloody well not. And I think, after the first testimony from, we were all very shattered by what this delightful man had talked about. And so we were very upset. So there were a couple of things we did. So the first thing we did was, I said, right, everybody gets a sheet of what is kind of white transparent paper, which you can stick on the wall and it sort of sticks there. And you get a you get a marker pen and you write the testimony on the bit of paper, this sort of acetate paper which goes on the wall, and we stick it up. So we memorialize each person. There they are, and they've got a different color. And each person took it in turns to write notes. So as they were talking, one person would write in brief what they were talking about. So we were sort of memorializing them. And by the end of the week, our entire edits week was just a scrawl, all three-sided scrawl all the way around the room of all these testimonies. And that sort of helped, I think, just sounds a bit pompous, but sort of consecrate what was going on and make us feel very much more connected to the people who we cared for deeply. They were taking a risk as far as we were concerned. I think in retrospect, I don't think they were taking a risk. I think they knew what they were doing much more than we did. But at the time, it felt like they were taking a risk.
I just wanted to pause on that because it's interesting how something you were doing in order to show respect and as part of the process of documenting these stories then became something that was so helpful, because there's so many mental health environments, indeed, where you hear people's experience in this organic way. I know for myself, there's something in us as people that we want to protect, we want to help, and we want to do something with this information. And even just sharing it is such a help in terms of, you know, processing it rather than holding it just on our own.
Yes, and that's exactly right. I would agree with that, Bobby. I think there were two things that I'd like to say about that. The first is that we felt often after we'd had somebody come into the box, there was usually a period of time, perhaps 3/4 of an hour, because they had to sort of COVID disinfect the box before the next person came in. So we had a bit of time. And we were very deliberately spent that time talking about how we felt about what we just heard, not in terms of, oh, how are we going to make this work in the documentary, or, oh, that connection works with that person, or that person works with that idea. Nothing as sort of directed as that. It was just purely how we felt. And that was absolutely mirroring what had been going on with the box, is that people were going in there and they were on their own. All right. We were listening and watching in the second time, but we were not intervening. And at no point did we intervene. And obviously in the first recording 20 years ago, no one intervened, no one was there. And that was very important, because it felt to me that the people to come to terms with what either you've gone through or what you've listened, it was very important. And what was so successful about the box was that no one was being judged and no one was being rescued. People were allowed to say what they wanted to say, safe in the knowledge that it was theirs, it was always going to be theirs, and they were never going to have to sort of feel that it was going to be had to be responded to. And I think that was very important, even in the process of each interview, each person that came out of the box, each testimony. We would sit and talk, and people would just talk. The three of us would sit in the room, we would just talk about it. And no one would judge the other person. No one would try and rescue them if they felt sad or felt distraught. We just let them speak. And that was, I think, a really effective and therapeutic way for both us in the experience of listening to it, but also the people who were in the box back 20 years ago and now. It was their story and they were allowed to own it. And no one was going to judge, rescue, intervene, even feel sorry for them. It was theirs and they got to hold it the way they wanted to. And that was, I think, very cleansing, I would have thought. I don't know whether Don feels that.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
And you were going to share another thing that you did as part of this process.
Well, it was more about the overall feeling that we got from all the people that came back into the booth. There were two or three that had really struggled since 9/11, and they were very honest in the way they described their struggles. And it was noticeable how, not insular, but they hadn't shared it much. they hadn't talked much to people. And I think that was really interesting that they had struggled a bit. And there was a phrase that Don used. We didn't use it in the film, unfortunately, but he said it. He was thanking people that had been there for him the year after Shelley's death. I think it was your birthday, Don. And people came around and celebrated. You went upstairs and shed a quiet tear, which I completely understand. And then you said very movingly, you know, I just want to thank all those people who were there for me in the months and years after 9/11. It takes a village, you said. And I thought, I'd not heard that phrase before. I think it's an American phrase. I thought, yeah, that's right. And in fact, so many people in the box talked about little connections that they've been making to individuals, families, but in their job, in their workspace, wherever it was, the people that were able to sort of look back and reflect on their feelings then and how they'd moved on had almost invariably made profound connections with other people and shared the experience of what they'd gone through. And that became an overriding message for us, not just for the film in terms of 9/11, but actually the way we were making the film, which was, we're making this film in the middle of COVID, where people are locked down. No one can come out of their front doors and people are isolated. And we all know the mental health struggles that so many people, particularly the young, have had in the last couple of years. And our film was really showing a clear route through this, which was, you can get past it. And the first thing to do is to open the door and go and talk to somebody.
Yeah. And I remember, I think it's one of the last lines in the film, one of the participants, Eric, says, it's okay to not be okay, to embrace discomfort until it passes. You know, like you say, there's such parallels here, where absolutely that is clearly something that mentality helped him through all the years since. And yet it's also so relevant to what we're living through at the moment. And Don, do you mind sharing a bit of what that experience was like, both recording again in the box during the pandemic and sort of looking back at that time through today's lens in, again, a situation which we did not see coming and is affecting the whole world?
My first reaction when I think of COVID and 9/11 is, what the hell happened? We all pulled together after 9/11. And I remember I sat down just a few weeks ago. My son was home for Christmas and he hadn't seen Memory Box yet, so we watched it together. And I remember looking at all the guys at Ground Zero doing the work, and they all had face masks on. Nobody was saying, it's my right not to wear a face mask. You know, we all pulled together to help each other out. And things have just frayed to such a point that we're going to argue over a piece of fabric that could save lives. You know, that's I'll stop the rant there. In terms of, you know, I do look at the kids and wonder what kind of impact this will have on them, this going through COVID. But I think the fact that they weathered 9/11 bodes well for them. I think, you know, for me, going through 9/11 and the lessons I learned from it to value moments and beauty and love, those were things I was able to kind of foster during that COVID period where I was isolated with my family. So for me, it was almost like that old Brer Rabbit, don't throw me in the briar patch. If you're going to isolate me with my family, I'm thrilled, because I just think the world of all of them. And I made the most of it. So I don't know if that's what you were.
No, absolutely. No, thank you. And I'm reminded of as well a parallel, you know, that here as well, that we saw such humanity out of both experiences. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine who was there in New York on that day talked about how immediately when it happened, your world falls apart and you don't know who you are. You don't know what way is up and you can't just contemplate anything. Almost your own name, you could forget it.
Right.
And then also so quickly what rushes in is the people, how strangers are interacting and trying to figure it out together, how people are mm-hmm. rushing in to help and check each other are okay in a way that in our day-to-day lives we just wouldn't. And you see the humanity rush back. And one of the most moving parts of the film for me watching it was people talking about how people came from all over America because that impact had been so far-reaching and people had such a drive to run in and help. And I think to an extent, we still have got that with the pandemic. I think primarily we saw it with healthcare workers and people that were on the ground and showed up and worked incredible hours with less colleagues under such risk day in, day out. But we also saw how individual people did their best at a time when we couldn't comfort each other in other ways that we're used to. We still found ways to connect, you know, even if it's just via Zoom. And we'll start wrapping up, but I want to ask you a similar question, David. Making this documentary during this time, you've talked about in other interviews I've seen how much it taught you about where we're at today and how to cope with whatever can come up in life. Would you mind sharing how that came to you? Was that something you ever thought going into this project that it would teach you so much about COVID and where the world is today? Or was that something that sort of surprised you with some of the testimonies you've heard?
I think it surprised me. I think there is, I'm perhaps cautioning myself always to manage my expectations going into any kind of film, because you hope and hope and sometimes those hopes are dashed. So I was really surprised by it because there was such a clear message coming through. You referenced a few moments ago about Eric talking about being, it's okay to be not okay. There were a couple of other people that mentioned that, which we didn't use in the film, but there were two other people that came back to the booth who used the same phrase. And I found that to be a really important message, particularly now, particularly where there has been, you know, so much distress and unhappiness and grief. And in a way, we're so often, I think, slightly channeled into this idea that everything has to be fine, everything has to be perfect. We have to live this kind of idyllic or managed life where we are in control of everything, and we're not. And the pandemic has absolutely proven we are absolutely not. And in a way, those messages are saying, look, there's going to be joy and there's going to be loss. Treat them both the same and accept the fact that it's not always going to be okay. And that's okay. That is okay. That's going to teach you and give you the sort of resilience to know and to manage your expectations. And that's a message particularly for young people who are constantly on the stage with social media, be it whatever platform it is. They're always on stage. They're always being judged. They're always being looked at. And they're constantly referring back onto themselves as to whether they're doing okay. And parents can often be very pressurizing on them, and schools and universities and all the rest of it. But actually, you know, there's a message that came out of that film that we made, which was that it's okay. When it doesn't go well, you'll get through it, as long as you know that it's okay that it's not going well.
Thank you. And I find even, you know, you sharing that phrase was used by multiple people very heartwarming, because from a mental health background, I see how often it's used by mental health charities around the world. And so, you know, I would hope that that's in part a sign that, you know, even if it was just for one of those people, that that's where they may have heard that phrase and had it normalized, that concept. And in going on through this film, it reaches so many other people, because it's okay not to be okay is such a phrase that resonates with us. And on that point, was there one last thing you wanted to say, Don?
I just wanted to say, I think the next logical extension of that is that it's okay to ask for help. You know, sometimes you just, there's too much at stake. Like I said, with when in my case with the kids, there was too much at stake for me. I needed to ask for help, and I got it from a counselor. And that really did set the stage for all the good things that happened afterwards. So, you know, it's okay to not be okay. And it's also okay to say, I can't do this alone and I need some help. I wanted to add that, I had a lot of friends who tuned into the show and watched the documentary. And I don't think they expected to walk away at the end feeling as good as they did. For Americans, 9/11 is just, it's a raw wound. And the documentary was a bandage. It was it helped to heal that wound. So thank you very much, David and Bjorn. And I'll sign off.
Thank you so much.
I totally endorse that.
And on that note, then, we will wrap up there. But David, would you mind sharing if people want to find the film and engage more with not just this, but I guess the work in general, right back to Ruth's original recordings?
Well, the film itself is still being shown on Sky Television, on the Sky documentary channel. And you can also see it on Now TV, which is becoming more and more popular, I gather. So those are the two places that you can find it. And I would urge people to go and watch it and hope they enjoy it. Ruth Sergel was the artist that came up with the original idea, and she has a website on which you can find all the testimonies and properly archived. That website is streetpictures.org/V for Victor 911/.
Thank you so much. And I'll include some links in the episode description as well. Thank you again for your time today and for such an incredible film.
Thank you so much, Bobby. I hope it was useful. We much enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.